I'm Dan Rodericks, and you're listening to Midday. In May, when Holly Freistadt was appointed the city's first food policy director, the Baltimore Sun reported her arrival while noting that more than two-thirds of the city's adults and almost 40% of high school students are overweight or obese. In addition, many low-income families do not have access to healthy food on a regular basis. The Food Czar aims to improve food in schools, bring an end to the city's food deserts, and transform vacant lots into green spaces. But how do you get a city to change its eating habits, especially when the population has developed a taste for cheap, fast, and sugary food? A conversation with a Food Czar and how one woman attempts to give an entire city a dietary makeover. That's next on Midday after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. The toll-free number is 866-661-9309, and the Midday email address is midday@wypr.org. How's the garden coming? Are you growing your own this year in Baltimore or anywhere nearby? Are you just getting into gardening? We'd like to hear from you in this hour of the show. Do you live in Baltimore City and you're curious about, you know, getting into the gardening thing? We'd like to hear from you during this hour of Midday. A program note, tomorrow on our show, Richard Gephardt. Remember Richard Gephardt? He was House Majority Leader for, well, at least a few years, and he was minority leader for several other years in the U.S. House of Representatives. 28 years altogether in Congress. Richard Gephardt now out and about. He's going to visit our studio tomorrow and talk some politics with us, talk about human rights and health care, the state of the nation, and how he's shaping the debates on health and medical policy. Richard Gephardt, our guest tomorrow on the show. And then in the second hour of our program, should journalists who publish critical national secrets face prosecution for exercising their First Amendment rights? That's Midday on Tuesday, June 22nd. A reminder that you can get all program notes for Midday off the WYPR.org website, or go to Midday with Dan Rodericks on Facebook or the Dan Rodericks Facebook page and be my friend. And you can see what's ahead each week on Midday and also in my column in the Baltimore Sun. The last time the Baltimore City Zoning Code was revised was 1971. City Planning Director Thomas Stosur, did I pronounce his name correctly? S-T-O-S-U-R, Thomas Stosur, our city planning director, told the Baltimore Sun last week that back then, quote, the world was very much automobile dominated, the suburbs were exploding, and state-of-the-art zoning sought to mimic the suburbs, resulting in large parking lots and fewer opportunities to walk. Now Baltimore aims to change the zoning code to encourage people to seek out and frequent grocery stores, farmers markets, community gardens, instead of the corner stores and fast food joints that are so accessible now. The city has developed a draft code that will be presented at a series of public meetings. And joining us to talk more about how revamping the city's zoning will improve our overall health is Laurie Feinberg, Chief of Comprehensive Planning for the City Planning Department. Hello, Laurie Feinberg. Nice to have you with us here on Midday.
Thank you.
And also with us is Madeline Shea, co-investigator on a health impact assessment of to transform Baltimore. Did I have that correct?
You did.
And you're a member of the Zoning Advisory Committee to the Planning Department. And for over 12 years, is this true, Madeline Shea, that you've championed structural systems, policy, regulatory, and media strategies to improve public health?
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for being here, both of you. But I'm going to start our hour here with Baltimore's new food czar. That's what she's become known as. The Baltimore City Food Policy Director, Holly Freistadt, is with us. She's been on the job just, what, a month or so?
2 months.
2 months now. And the media has dubbed you food czar.
Correct.
And are you okay with the title? Do you mind if I call you Food Czar during this hour of Midday?
You can call me Food Czar, but we need to redefine what Food Czar is.
Well, that's why we have you here.
Great.
What is a Food Czar? What's in your job description? What are you going to be doing in Baltimore City?
Okay. So contrary to popular belief, I am not here to tell people what to eat or how to eat, and I'm not doing this alone. We have a food policy task force, and we're working together as a team with many partners to be able to start to improve access to healthy, affordable food. food in food deserts in Baltimore City.
Now, this food policy task force has been in place for a while, and there's a panel of experts, people in city government and outside of city government.
Since 2008, yes.
Yeah. And they hired you, but actually your salary is paid for with some foundation money. Is that right?
So we created the Sustainable Food Fund has been created, mm-hmm. And so several foundations have provided grants to the Sustainable Food Fund through Baltimore Community Foundation, and that's where my funding's coming from.
Holly Freistadt, you're a Maryland native?
Yes.
But you went away for a little while.
Yes, 14 years.
Well, tell us about your career. This is very interesting to me. You actually got a Master's of Science from Tufts in Food Policy and Applied Nutrition.
Yes.
Right. So, and what drew you, first of all, I'm just interested, what drew you to this area?
To the area of nutrition?
So not Baltimore, but to the area
to
of nutrition.
Field.
Yes.
So it all started, I was living right after college on a small island, Lopez Island, in the San Juan Islands off of, it's in Washington State, but it's an hour and a half north of Seattle. Mm-hmm. And we were living in an area, and I just came back from Nepal recently, and I was so surprised that there was a lack of access issue. We had a lot of livestock on the island, and we could not eat local meat. And so I started to work with a nonprofit there to really... We founded the first USDA-inspected mobile slaughter facility so that we could raise meat on the island humanely and then be able to have it USDA-inspected and served at our supermarkets and at restaurants.
All so, that beef was being raised on the island and sent somewhere else.
Yes, and never coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to realize, when I was in developing nations, I knew that there was a food access issue. But I was surprised to find that in our country of abundance, that we're having this disconnect of food access. So it all started back on Lopez Island. And since then, I went to Seattle, lived there, Anacortes, and now we're here in Baltimore.
So living on Lopez Island drew you to the discipline of food nutrition?
No, I have my undergraduate in nutrition.
You already did. Okay.
And then after my time working on Lopez Island, I went to Tufts University to study agriculture, food, and the environment, AFE. It's a food policy degree.
Okay. So tell us about the years since then, before you came back to Maryland.
So just a few things that I worked on. After I graduated from Tufts, I went to Seattle, and I worked for Washington State University Extension, and I founded a program called CHANGE. Cultivating Health and Nutrition Through Gardening Education, where we taught nutrition through gardening education in low-income schools. So we brought in school gardens, classroom gardening. We had the students growing their food and eating their food in the classroom and learning the implications of health.
Hmm.
And so that's one of the projects I worked on.
Did you find during this time that there's this massive disconnection between what we eat and how it's grown, that was something, we've talked about it a lot on this show. In the last 2 years that I've been doing this show, we've talked about local food production, farmers markets, gardening, quite a bit, because there seems to be a lot of interest in it the last couple of years, and hopefully it's not just a trend, but that it was something that will latch on and become part of the culture. But culturally speaking, there is this big disconnect between what we eat and our understanding of where it comes from and how it's grown.
It's absolutely true. And so that's why we start young. We start with elementary school kids, teaching them where their food comes from, especially where vegetables and fruits come from. And we see that as we teach children and they start to grow food and cook food, they're more likely to eat healthier.
Now, so we're going to use the term food czar, but we say it with a little grin. Okay. And you said you're not here to tell people what to eat.
Correct.
But don't people want to be told what to eat?
Not by me.
That's not in your job
that's
description.
Not my
you
job.
Don't want
to
do that.
I don't think people want to be told what to do. I really don't. I think when people ask and they're really receptive and there's reasons that they want to change their eating habits, there's lots of resources and people who can help them. But really what my role here is to give people the choice to have healthy, affordable food. And they can choose to eat it or not eat it.
Well, the one thing we can tell people is what the health picture looks like in Baltimore City, what the indications are for heart disease, for instance, obesity. Why don't we start with some of the problems that you'll be addressing?
So as we know, in Baltimore City, we have food deserts. And a food desert is an area where people do not have access to a grocery store. And by Johns Hopkins, they define it as a quarter mile walking.
A quarter mile. If you're beyond a quarter mile, you're in a desert?
It can be. If you look at the federal or the national stats, it says 1 to 4 miles. But when Johns Hopkins continued their work, they're doing extensive work on food mapping in Baltimore City. And they realize that when people are carrying their groceries and they have children at hand and they're taking public transportation or they're walking, that a quarter mile is pretty much their limits.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're looking at food deserts, we're looking at where the closest grocery store is, or supermarket. We're also looking at whether they have transportation or not, a car. We're also looking at their income levels. And what we see in food deserts is we tend to see an abundance of corner stores and a lot of fast food restaurants. And it's easy and affordable right now to get cheap food, unhealthy food. So what we want to be able to do in Baltimore cities is to improve the corner stores, not to say no corner stores, but say let's have healthy corner stores, work with the corner stores owners. And Johns Hopkins has already started this research and work to bring and change a landscape in the food deserts so there's an abundance of fruits and vegetables that are healthy and affordable.
Changing the landscape so that actually you see apples and oranges and celery or something when you go into a corner store.
Yes. I mean, there's many ways that we could be changing the landscape of food. It could be through the corner store so that you can see fruits and vegetables. It could be fresh or it could be in the frozen section. It could be at the farmer's market that you can now use your independence cards if you're a food stamp recipient and be able to shop at the farmer's market. It could be that maybe in the future we'll have some mobile vending that has healthy fruits and vegetables, street vending, and so forth.
Is the theory that if it's accessible, if it's there, people will use it?
Yes. So according to the researchers, many publications, one is Grocery Gap by PolicyLink, and the White House just published a report in May, a childhood obesity report that also talks about the access issue. If there's an increased access to healthy food, people will be more likely to eat it as long as it's affordable.
So that follows. I mean, that actually happens when it's practiced.
Healthy and affordable and accessible. So it can't just
be healthy. Affordable, accessible.
It has to be affordable and accessible.
Yeah. Well, what about all that? That seems, so some people, they will say, okay, affordability, gee, fresh produce, how are you going to get it there? You need to truck it in. Processed food is so much cheaper. How are you going to do that? How are you going to encourage, say, a corner grocery store on Fulton Avenue someplace to stock these things?
So there are several approaches. I'm going to answer this in a more global scale first. So one is in our food deserts, we have quite a bit of vacant land right now. The city owns vacant land, and we're going to be seeing in the future the ability to be able to farm urban farms on vacant land. We have a supply and demand issue, very similar to Lopez Island, actually,
mm-hmm.
Where we're starting to have more demand for healthy, affordable food, a lot of it being local. And we also have a lot of farmers who would like to be able to supply that. Now, what we're seeing right now is that we need more urban farmers. We need to be able to have food in the food deserts being grown by people in the area that could then source at the corner stores, that could then go to the farmer's market, that could have community-supported agriculture. So we really want to be able to nurture and create the opportunity through land use for urban farms. It's just one of the several solutions.
So just imagine for a moment some section of Baltimore that's been abandoned for a long time, that's sitting there waiting for something to happen and nothing's happening. I mean, the city had a population of about 1 million people once upon a time, the end of World War II, and here we are in 2010, and the population's about 635,000, right? So there's all this space. So one imagines transforming that space into corn, into things that are people can eat. Is that right? I mean, do you see that?
That's part of the answer, yes.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not the only answer, but it's an important part.
Well, when you mention this to people, some think it's far-fetched. Others get excited about it. What's been the reaction when you talk to folks about this?
I think there's been a lot of excitement. I mean, I have just been welcomed in the city, and there's been a lot of media on this issue, which is a sign that people are excited and they do want to see this happen.
Holly Freistadt is with us, Baltimore's food policy director. We can also call her the Baltimore food czar. You're welcome to call in and ask questions. And as I mentioned, Laurie Feinberg is here from the planning department, Madeline Shea from the health department, right? Madeline Shea, we're going to speak to you about these zoning changes in Baltimore and whether it's possible to transform city blocks into urban farms. I mean, what do you think of that idea, Baltimore? Can I hear from you? 410-662-8780 with your comments, questions, reflections on this. Send me a brief email. I'll read it on the air if it's nice. midday@wypr.org. Even if you disagree, you can send an email. 866-661-9309. Perhaps you're listening from another urban environment someplace, another city where they're already growing things. We'd love to hear from you. 866-661-9309. Welcome back to Midday. Transform Baltimore, a new city initiative that will help the city's new food czar, Holly Freistadt, with some of these ideas that she's expressing here in this hour of midday. As I said, Laurie Feinberg from the City Planning Department is with us, and Madeline Shea from the City Health Department. And we heard there was some news in the last week, as I mentioned, about zoning changes in Baltimore. So let me start with you, Laurie. Laurie Feinberg, thanks again for being here. The city's zoning has not been revised since 1971. Is that right?
That is correct.
There's been a master plan or something since then. But what changes specifically would address what Holly Freistadt's talking about here?
Well, first of all, we have a draft of a new code out on the street, and welcome public and community input into that draft. Our next meeting is tomorrow night at Morgan State, and we also have one on June 29th. Some of the things that are in the draft of the new code are relatively straightforward. For example, community gardens are established as a use, and they would be permitted in all districts. We've also created a new category called urban agriculture. And that is reflective of this growing interest in more of a, I'd say, beyond just the garden with the flowers, but really growing substantial amounts of food. We've made provisions for that in residential neighborhoods with conditions, because that can have a little bit more of an impact on a community. There may be sales, there may be trucks or something that come in, but it's generally seen as something that can happen in many, many areas of our city.
Can I ask this before we go forward? The 1971 revision I talked about, it pretty much banned urban farming. Is there such a thing, that phrase, urban farming, does it show up in the zoning codes?
No, it didn't show up in the zoning codes. There were some vague references to agriculture. But in 1971, from the best that we can figure on the history, the city was kind of proud that it wasn't agricultural. It was sort of a sign of, you know, moving away from that history. And so it was moving in a different direction. There were very, very few provisions for anything agricultural.
Most of the focus on zoning in 1971 was for what? Sidewalks, streets, cars, parking for the commuters?
Development. Zoning only speaks to the private property, not the streets and the sidewalks so much. But it was mostly oriented towards still a very strong industrial base in Baltimore. You know, we still had the steam, you know, the factories and the smokestacks, as well as a vision of growth and development that was based on more of a separation of uses rather than a mixed use. And I think that's what we're realizing. We need to move towards a mix, make our city much more walkable, and reflect the new ways of doing business.
Madeline Shea, what's the health department's part of this and part of Transform Baltimore?
We are really excited about the planning department's leadership in updating the code so that it can address issues that are now prominent in public health that weren't 40 years ago or when the original code came about over 100 years ago. So right now, if you look at neighborhoods in Baltimore, there's a 20-year difference in life expectancy. And that maps onto issues such as access to food. It maps onto crime. So aspects of the built environment affect safety, food access, walkability, not just the traditional separation of unhealthy and healthy uses, which is what, you know, would have predominated in 1971 and back at the turn of the century.
So actually, the way the city has been designed, the way the city is sort of structured in these last 40 years or so, has not been conducive to anything like this. In the old days, it probably was more produce and food available on wagons, on carts, on small stores, right? And in the age of the supermarkets, supermarkets disappeared in the inner city. I remember at one point, I forget what year it was, giant supermarket finally opened a supermarket in Baltimore City, and it had been 20 years since Giant had opened its previous market in Baltimore City. Those are the kind of things you're talking about, the urban landscape.
Absolutely. Access to supermarkets has a big impact on what people will be able to eat.
Can we encourage supermarkets to come into Baltimore City, Holly Freistadt? Do they want to do business here?
So since 2000, we've had 16 new supermarkets in Baltimore City.
So it's already happened.
It's already happening. And so what we want to do is continue to encourage supermarkets to in the city, also help them stay in the city, and also provide healthy food through corner stores and places where we cannot necessarily get supermarkets into the city.
Madeline Shea, so you like the vision of this and from a health point of view, the idea of food being grown a few blocks away from where people will actually maybe buy it and take it home and cook it. Is that part of the vision?
Absolutely. The public health field is moving away from an emphasis just on, oh, you need a vaccine and you will therefore be healthy, to a much deeper understanding that the environments in which we live are critical to our health, our ability to get to not only food, but healthcare, jobs are all really important, as well as lighting, factors that will affect crime and stress. Mm-hmm. A lot of health disparities now are being linked with chronic stress. So we're very excited partners with the planning department.
410-662-8780. If you'd like to join our conversation here, we'd like to hear from you. Daphne in West Baltimore, why don't we start with you? We'll jump right in here with Daphne. Hello, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I was just calling in to say I think this is a great idea. I live in a section of Baltimore, Penn Hills, where you know there's room in our yards for gardens, and gardens where we grow flowers, gardens where we grow vegetables. But a lot of people live in row houses or apartments where they don't really have that space in their own yard. And to have these community gardens, be able to use vacant lots and turn them into something where people can go and grow their own food, I think is a huge benefit for the city.
Well, thank you very much, Daphne. Holly Freistart, what is meant by a supermarket that's not really a supermarket, that's an imaginary supermarket?
What do you mean by that?
Not imaginary. What's the term?
Virtual supermarket?
Virtual. Yeah. Thank you. My imaginary friend just told me. He's in the next room. Thank you very much, Marcus Charleston. A virtual supermarket.
So the virtual supermarket is a very innovative way that the health department has launched 4 months ago in food deserts at two libraries, where we are having low-income populations or anyone who would like to access a virtual supermarket to come to the library. They place their order online because many people do not have a computer. They go to the library. They help placing their order online. And then the next day, the local grocer will deliver the produce and the food to the virtual library.
So what was imaginary actually becomes real. And
right.
How is this going over, Madeline Shea? Can you tell us?
I think we've had quite a big increase in the use of the virtual supermarket resource. It takes some time for people, you know, our shopping behaviors are things we get into habits.
Mm-hmm.
But as more and more people are becoming aware of this resource and how easy it is, we're seeing an increase in the utilization.
There's two Enoch Pratt branches doing this now. One the Southeast branch, the Anchor in Highlandtown? Do you know?
So there's two. There's Orleans
Street
and Washington Village.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay,
yes.
Orleans Street and Washington Village. So do folks know that they can go there and do this online?
So we're working on the promotion, and it's increasing over time. So I would say over the last 4 months, it's been improving, and it's been a success so far.
Okay. And we just did our part by mentioning it again. Orleans Street and Washington Village, Enoch Pratt branches. So you can actually go there and order from a supermarket online and then get your delivery at the same location.
Yes, and you can go online to get the details.
Okay. Here's another call. Laura in Annapolis. She's ready to go. Welcome to Midday, Laura.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to thank you guys so much for featuring all of this on your program this afternoon. I caught the tail end. I teach middle school science just north of Annapolis at a private school. And we have worked hard the last couple of years to become a Maryland Green School. And one of the big components of the program for us has been a push to teach our students about where their food comes from. And we've got a club, for example, called From Dirt to Dinner, where we have an organic garden outside of one of our classrooms in our schoolyard. Students are responsible for growing their own vegetables. We have a big celebration when we harvest everything at the end of the school year, and we integrate trips to the local organic markets. And by focusing on, and learning about where their food is coming from, I think the students have acquired such a neat sense of ownership and responsibility for what they're putting into their own bodies.
Any comment on that, Holly?
Yes. So Maryland Extension has a curriculum called Growing Habits, and currently it's in elementary schools that are low-income elementary schools, but it could be used in many other locations as well. And I think some of it could be used in middle school.
Laurie Feinberg, there have already been a couple of hearings on the new draft zoning code, right? What's been going on there? What kind of questions are you getting?
Well, we're getting questions all over the place. I think as zoning code speaks to any number of things, we have a whole revamping of new categories, really reflecting the new world we're in that is different than 40 years ago. For example, industrial zoning has completely changed than where we were 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, how many smokestacks kind of before, and now we're finding the need for much more creative combinations of industry and business together, live-work buildings. We didn't have those provisions in our existing code. The loft buildings, mm-hmm. the artists, craftsmen. So we've been getting some very good feedback on some of those ideas.
How about on urban gardening? What kind of questions are you getting there? Do the questions speak to an excitement or a suspicion or skepticism about it?
We've only gotten positive feedback about the urban gardening, and we've also gotten some positive feedback about the ability to put in some neighborhood commercial uses, the having those walkable stores and that sort of thing. Some concern about how they'll operate, mm-hmm. but very overall very positive.
Do these questions sound familiar to you? These are from Aaron in Baltimore. He says, I think this is a good idea. I'm just curious about how these issues are going to be dealt with. One, how are you going to keep rats from eating the crops in these urban gardens? And two, how are you going to protect the urban gardens from theft? If I'm having difficulty feeding three kids, an unguarded garden one block down is going to become a tempting target. Have you heard those questions before, Laurie Feinberg?
We haven't at the zoning meetings, but Holly probably
Maybe Holly
has.
Freistadt yeah. has, or Madeline Shea. Holly Freistadt.
Yes, I have heard those comments. And so what we have found is that community gardens embrace the community. So there's less vandalism when the community is involved. So when we're looking at community gardens or we're looking at urban farming in the city, it needs to work with the community because it's to serve the community. So there's less issues of vandalism when the community embraces it. We're not coming in and telling neighborhoods that they have to have community gardens and we're going to make you do it. Mm-hmm. If they want to do it, we would like to allow them to do so. So that addresses the issue of really the vandalism. And the issue of rats and other pests, there's lots of strategies to farm and grow food responsibly to reduce the amount of pests. It really does not need to be an issue at all.
It can be done. You can even have some compost without rats.
Absolutely.
Say possible. We had Novella Carpenter here, you know, who wrote the book about urban gardening, Farm City. I'm so glad Marcus is in the next room. And she mentioned, you know, that problem and said exactly the same thing. And she had some remedies for dealing with it. She also mentioned that she gives away or allows people to take some of her food. And at first she wondered how far that would go if she would, you know, start experiencing theft on a big scale. But she doesn't. And she found with a couple of people, even though they don't contribute much to her garden, if they take some mustard greens now and then, they keep an eye out for her garden for others. They feel a little bit invested in it. Not that they would ever actually invest anything, but they just, you know, they feel like partly it belongs to them in some way.
So you bring up a really good point. These gardens and farms are going to be in food deserts. The purpose, one part of it, is to provide food to those food deserts. So really, there should not be any stealing needed because some of that food will remain right in the food desert or all of the food will remain in the food desert.
Right.
So that shouldn't be an issue either.
I should mention back on the zoning code, Laurie Feinberg from the planning department mentioned tonight, it's 6 to 7:30?
Tomorrow night.
I'm sorry, June 22nd. I'm sorry, tomorrow night, 6 to 7:30 p.m. at Morgan State University in the Student Center, room 212. And then again on June 29th, if you want to hear about these plans and offer some input, June 29th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Department of Planning's open house at 417 East Fayette Street up on the 8th floor.
Thank you.
It says, please join us for a brief presentation and discussion of the recently drafted Baltimore City Zoning Code. And we're speaking about it today in the context of food in Baltimore City and supplying food to people who don't have terrific access to it right now. Fresh food. The food policy director, Holly Freistadt, is with us, and Madeline Shea from the city health department as well. Susan in Baltimore, let's take your call. Welcome to Midday.
Hi. I had a comment based on my living in the Connecticut, New Haven area, but was familiar with what happened in Hartford when they introduced a farmer's market into a low-income neighborhood and coupled it with a high-end restaurant, which used the locally grown produce and employed a lot of the local people, so there was certainly a lot of community investment. Just wondered if you'd heard about that.
Oh, yes. I know Mark Winnie well. And
He runs the program there?
Not anymore, but he was responsible. And he's actually, what's it called? Not ad hoc, but a professor at Johns Hopkins. He's
adjunct.
He's an honorarium, or he's
has a chair.
No.
He's a fellow.
Nope.
One of those things.
Anyway, he is providing resources. He works for the Community Food Security Coalition.
Oh. So he's here now.
No, he's not here. He is providing resources to us. So, for example, he's working with the Community Food Security Coalition, and we've had conversations and been working together on how to bring food policy issues to Baltimore City.
I read that in the Philadelphia area, they've drawn a big map, right? A 100-mile radius of Philadelphia, in the hopes of assessing, doing an inventory, is that right, of food that's grown in that area?
So that's being done here as well. So Johns Hopkins Center for Livable Future has been doing an extensive food mapping project, very similar to the work that you're discussing or mentioning, to really be able to see what resources and assets we have in the city and where our issues lie related to food access.
So the hopes of that would be, after you have an inventory, then you know what's available locally for a local purchase? Versus, farmers within a 100-mile radius of a city just selling their produce or whatever elsewhere?
I would say it's more of a tool for us. So, for example, they've mapped out where the farmers markets are. They've mapped out where the corner stores are so that we can start to really look at how many corner stores are in this area and how can we be able to target bringing healthy corner stores into certain neighborhoods.
I see.
So it's more of a resource in that way for us.
Your assessment would include farmers in the region, too?
So they have done some on farming. One of the things that we're working right now is to assess what farmers are at which farmers markets, how many of them are coming from Baltimore City and Baltimore County, in hopes that in the future, once we do have urban farming, that we'll have urban farmers from Baltimore City at the farmers markets in Baltimore City.
What will compel people who have developed a taste for fast food to eat vegetables and fruit more often?
In some cases, their doctors will be giving them some advice about how that can be helpful. So, for example, when we looked at the difference in life expectancy between different neighborhoods, you can see that what's driving that are differences in cardiovascular disease, diabetes, issues like this, where food really matters. It matters to your life expectancy. So I think people are becoming much more in touch with this. And even asthma, people don't realize that asthma, a really healthy diet, is going to impact the severity of your asthma. For children who've been lead poisoned, a healthy diet is important. So I think, caring parents are wanting to be able to access more of what they need to have healthy children and be healthy themselves.
Well, I guess we'll find out. It's interesting. I mean, people have been told these things for years, right? They've been told these things for years about changing diet, especially to attack hypertension, diabetes, those heart disease, right? But if they haven't had the access, the easy, what did you say, easy, affordable, and healthy?
Healthy, affordable, and accessible.
Accessible. If it's not there, then it's just makes the whole thing harder, doesn't it? 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. If you'd like to join our conversation, that's Madeline Shea from the Health Department, Holly Freistart, the city's new food policy director, or food czar, if you like, and Laurie Feinberg from the city planning department as well. Midday email address, I got a couple of emails to read when we get back. midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. We had a question earlier. The caller had to leave, but the question was about city soil. One assumes that the soil in urban areas, especially maybe areas that have been industrialized in the past or whatnot, may have some challenges as far as urban gardening goes. There may be contaminants in the soil, more so in the city than you would find in a rural area or even a suburban area. Is that being addressed or considered? Madeline Shea from the Health Department.
It is, and we've done research to look at what is in the soil and how bad is it for your health. And this is an industrial city, so there are areas where there's stuff in that soil that is harmful to health, particularly in drip lines of houses. So that's where the rain would drip off houses that are old. We tend to have high lead concentrations there. And then the legacy of leaded gasoline is that soil near major roads tends to have high amounts of lead, cadmium, zinc, copper, things that are byproducts of our car economy. So, but that is not a barrier for community gardens and urban agriculture because we have barrier methods or raised beds. There are ways that you can garden safely in this environment in Baltimore. So, but it's good for people to be aware of that if they're doing their own gardening in their own property.
Another question from Franklin in Southwest Baltimore. Please ask about keeping chickens or other small livestock in Baltimore. Where would or should this be allowed? Do you know? Does the health department actually allow you to have chickens in Baltimore? Do you know?
I think up to four. We're not all that keen on roosters because neighbors tend to consider them a nuisance.
Yeah, there is a noise ordinance.
Yes. The health department, we don't want our duty officers called every morning at 4 a.m. to handle the rooster
issue. But hens are very nice. They're quiet and they give you a little something every day, a little egg.
Yes, they do. Yeah. So small amounts are fine.
What about other, I mean, would urban agriculture move into livestock? I mean, could you see that happening, Holly Freistadt?
I mean, from the national perspective, there are some cities that are exploring those ideas. I think right now we're focusing on the urban farms with the produce and with the four chickens and so forth.
It would also be your hope that this would kind of carry over if we started seeing more community gardens in Baltimore, for instance, or we actually saw some entrepreneurial farmers starting small lots here and there, that other people in the city would get the idea of doing it in their own backyards.
Absolutely.
Those
and I think a lot of people are already gardening in their backyards, and I think that we're just bringing light on all the great work that Baltimoreans are doing and growing their own food.
I'm trying to get a sense of that. From listening to our listeners, you'd think everybody has a garden going in their backyard, or they're growing something these days. But I just wonder how widespread it's become. Certainly people are talking about doing this more, and there's certainly more interest in it. Graham in Waverly, we'll take your call next. Welcome to Midday, Graham.
Hi, my name is Graham Carell Allen, and I help out with a community garden here in Waverly. One of the really helpful programs that we benefited from when setting up our community garden was the city's composted waste collection. And we had a couple of dumps of this leaf mold dropped off as we were setting up our beds over the past couple of years, and it proved to be some really helpful soil. I recently heard that this the city's collection of and composting of leaves is ending, and that this stuff is not going to be available so much. So I was wondering, what is the city's plan in the future to help enable, larger scale community and urban farming with perhaps like a citywide composting program, or is anything in mind like that?
Madeline Shea.
As many of you are aware, the city is in a fiscal crisis right now, and I think the bottle tax is being considered again. It is very, very important that we have resources to continue to support really everything that DPW is doing, keeping a clean city and promoting clean and healthy gardens.
I wanted to ask Laurie Feinberg this question from the planning department. We're speaking here today about urban agriculture, urban farming, because under this new zoning code, Transform Baltimore, certainly there's a recognition here for community gardens and urban farms that we're talking. But the scope of this goes far beyond that.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So folks who are interested in attending would hear a plan for what? What other changes would there be? Touching on what other? You said mostly development, but what do you mean?
I mentioned some of the many new categories for our industrial, updating that. We have a new category called transit-oriented development, which would be a zone to go around our transit stations to encourage mixed-use development, better use of the transit, more living where you work. We have design guidelines throughout the new code, landscape guidelines, updated parking standards, residential development guidelines for residential neighborhoods.
Do the parking standards call for less parking?
Yes, actually, in some areas they do call for less parking. We are suggesting that in downtown that parking not be required at all. We have a well-served downtown as far as transit. And in the walk-to commercial areas, the low-density commercial areas, again, not requiring parking. It wouldn't be prohibited if the property owner could build it, but it wouldn't be required. So these are some of these are also health-related in the global picture, because we're talking about air quality, water quality things in the long run. They're for good land use planning, but they are also health-related.
For more information about all of this, the zoning codes revision, it's rewritebaltimore.org. That's the website. It's interesting you say Richard Nixon was president when the current zoning code was written, so it's being revised as a draft of a new code. Learn more and get involved. And I'll mention before we get off the air here, the two more presentations that are coming up, one on June 22nd, one on June 29th. Madeline Shea, did you want to say something?
Yeah, on that, it's not even just about air quality. People need to be active, too. So being able to be active and be out and about, so the new zoning code will have new measures that help people
walk more.
Walk more, yeah, and bicycle more with more bicycle parking. So all of that fits into having the healthy and safe communities that we need, so that if you actually have a healthy green corner store or supermarket, that people can get there and feel safe doing so.
Our phone number here for Midday, 410-662-8780. Holly Freistadt is the city's new food policy director, or food czar. Madeline Shea from the Health Department and Laurie Feinberg from the Planning Department for Baltimore City. Phil, we'll take your call next. Hi, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks.
I appreciate it. I love the reports of the programs that you're getting young people involved in. However, I remember way back in the 60s when I was working in a community group, and they had introduced new math in the schools, which is an old term, and most of the parents didn't have the slightest idea what their kids were learning. So I actually got my father, who was about to come in and teach a course, and the question I have is, are they coordinating these classes with the kids with the parents? In other words, it's one thing if the kids are learning stuff, but if the parents still don't understand how they do it or feel ignorant, it can't possibly have the impact that we would like it to have.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the concern is that there's a generation or two that's maybe been lost on home cooking, on getting fresh food or having that built as part of the regular daily routine. It's great to teach the kids this, but then they still go home to a parent that doesn't cook.
So there's many approaches that are already happening. One are there's family nights where students may be teaching their parents what they're learning in school. There's also the WIC classes for low-income women, mothers, to be learning how to eat better and access healthier food.
You could use those classes to teach them that.
Are they already doing that? Yeah.
There's cooking classes, nutrition classes.
Great. And then there's also Extension that is doing what's called SNAP education. So they're going into many elementary schools, low-income elementary schools, and working with the families as well as the students.
You have Tony Gerassi here already on the job for the Baltimore City Schools. I guess you've met him, spoken to him about what's going on there. I mean, you think like he's running things on his own there with the schools already?
He is moving forward in great speeds with the schools, and we will help in any ways that we can.
Yeah. And he's in addition to setting up some gardens at schools, they've done that.
So there's Great Kids Farm.
Yeah, Great Kids Farm on top of that. He's a dynamo. He wants a central kitchen, though. That's what he says.
He definitely wants a central kitchen, would be important.
Can we put that in the zoning code? I don't know if we can put the funding for a central kitchen in there. But see, Tony, we put in another plug for your central kitchen here. I wanted to ask Holly Freistadt this question. How does Baltimore compare to other cities? We know about Detroit. We talked about Detroit on this show, because they address their food deserts with a system of food vans that actually mobile units that bring food into these food deserts. They got a grant from the State Department of something, and they're doing that in Detroit now. But are other cities facing the same problems or challenges Baltimore is?
This is absolutely a national trend. with food deserts in the nation. And I have to say, more on a personal note, coming from Washington State and living out in the Pacific Northwest, I kind of had this image that, you know, Washington State, the West Coast, is so ahead of the times.
So progressive.
And I came here and I have been thoroughly impressed by the amount of work that's happening related to food deserts, related to food policy. Yes, we have issues. Yes, we need to address them. But there are so many great partners and such great work with the virtual supermarket and the work the schools are doing.
Johns Hopkins.
That there's
University
a lot,
of Maryland.
A lot already happening, and I'm just one of the players in a big picture here.
Yeah, we had a guest, I think she was from the University of Maryland, and pediatric health was her specialty, and they had a project that they were working on to try to get some fresh food, fresh fruits and vegetables into some of those corner stores. We meant to catch up with them to see how that project's going. But there is a lot going on here. So yeah. It isn't just me.
No, it's
just,
not you.
It
at
is
all.
Actually something that is actually happening a lot. Okay, good. Let's go to Suzanne in Edgewood to see what her impressions are. Hello, Suzanne.
Hi. You know, I love to eat fruits and vegetables in season, but I think that one of the deterrents is having recipes and knowing what to do with them. And there's a cookbook that I found a couple years ago that I just wanted to recommend because I've just passed it on to a lot of friends called Simply in Season. There's actually a committee of Mennonites from Pennsylvania that wrote this cookbook with the goal of encouraging people to eat the fruits and vegetables in season. And the recipes are really good, low-fat, and easy. And I just wanted to share that because if anyone's okay. looking for what to do with the vegetables, I think that that's a really good place to start. The kale recipe in there, I actually know what to do with kale now.
Yeah, but there's a lot of kale. Yeah. There's a lot of kale all of a sudden in certain times of the year, and a lot of Swiss chard right now. I'm running out of ideas for Swiss chard. But anyway, Suzanne, thanks for mentioning that. What is that? Just Simply in Season, but not the word simply. In Season, she said, was the title.
Simply in Season. Oh. And you can always...
Is the title Simply in Season,
yes.
Or is it Simply in Season?
I think it was Simply in Season.
Okay, all right.
When you have too much kale, just give you some advice, what we do when we have too much kale right now or some of these greens, we throw them in a pot of boiling water and then put them in a baggie and freeze them
and
eat them when it's no longer in season. Your nice, fresh, wonderful greens.
Can we transform Baltimore? Can we actually do that? Can we get people to do that?
We can.
Okay, we'll see. Bob in Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I was calling because I was just wondering why I haven't heard any talk about the Mount Claire Safeway being closed.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Bob, I wrote a couple of columns about that. If you can go on BaltimoreSun.com, you can look it up, and they explained why that one closed after, 20 years or so, maybe longer than that, 25 years. But will you be doing, Holly Freistadt, an assessment of supermarkets in the city to see where there's spots maybe you can encourage development?
So I think that there is work happening with Johns Hopkins. I think in their food mapping has been mapping out where the supermarkets are. And so one of the recommendations from the task force is to work with Johns Hopkins and other organizations and nonprofits in the city related to supermarkets and see if we can encourage and keep supermarkets in the city.
Was that part of your job, you think?
It's definitely to support and promote supermarkets in the city.
Judy in Baltimore County, let's take your call. We have time. You have to be brief, Judy.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that it's very easy to grow fruit trees if you have enough. You don't need a whole lot of land, and you can have apples and pears and cherries, and it's just great. And I know Baltimore is trying to increase the number of trees in the city.
We plant Bradford pears on the sidewalks all the time. Maybe we ought to plant some real pear tree. Pear trees that actually produces a pear. What about that, Holly Freistadt?
So actually, when I was living in Bellingham, Washington, we had a lot of fruit trees, and we started to collect, the neighborhoods collected the fruit trees, and they donated to the food banks, and it was a great resource.
This is all very exciting. Thank you very much, and good luck to you, Holly Freistadt, the city's food czar. Laurie Feinberg, the hearings are tomorrow night, 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Student Center at Morgan, and again at the Planning Department on East Fayette Street on June 29th at 6 p.m. Good luck with your project. Laurie Feinberg, thank you very much for being here. Madeline Shea, it was nice to meet you. Thank you for being on Midday today.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. That's our show for today. It's produced and engineered by Marcus Charleston, Vanessa Eskridge. Our executive producer is Jeff Brown. Lunch today, it was a very nice lunch. It included a salad, a fresh salad, from Peace and a Cup of Joe on East Pratt Street. Thank you, everyone. Stay tuned for the news from NPR, and I'll see you again tomorrow.